standing at the station and I'm waiting on my train to come. Well, I'm standing at the station and I'm waiting on my train to come. I can't stand around all day, you know I gotta run.
Hello, I'm Todd DeFeo, publisher and editor of railfanning.org. In an earlier episode, I introduced my talk, Death on the Rails. It's a look at the many ways death might befall people on the rails, whether they were workers, passengers, or innocent bystanders. As a part of my talk, I highlighted three wrecks, including a 1915 wreck involving a circus train near Columbus, Georgia. I wanted to share that part of my talk with you today. I hope you enjoy more from this presentation of Death on the Rails.
Perhaps the biggest tragedy of all the rail disasters, it really is the hundreds, the thousands probably, of people whose names we don't even know. And that took me back more than 100 years to November 22nd, 1915, just outside of Columbus, Georgia. On that day, a circus train that was part of the Con T. Kennedy Circus was running as an extra. It had 16 flat cars, 3 stock cars, 9 sleeping cars. It had departed Macon that morning and was heading west toward Columbus. Near Bull Creek, about 6.5 miles north of Columbus, engineer W.R. Biddick saw an approaching train. It was a passenger train that had departed Columbus, Georgia shortly after 1:10 p.m., and it was traveling probably about 30 miles an hour. Now, depending on the account, either Biddick, J.L. Fickling, who was the engineer of the passenger train, or both, threw on the train's emergency brakes. They threw their trains into reverse, and along with the firemen, they jumped to safety. The two trains collided. The circus train was authorized to be on the tracks. The passenger train was supposed to wait at a small station called Muskogee, but of course, it didn't. The passenger train steel coaches survived the collision with minimal damage. However, the first 9 cars of the circus train, wooden flat cars, were destroyed, catching fire. The scene can only be described as one of horror. As the Macon News reported, trees 20 feet from the wreck burst into flames. And despite the many horrors of that day, there emerged examples of heroism. Members of the circus worked diligently to save their cohorts who were trapped in the wreckage. It's said that they managed to pull as many as 18 to safety. One man, who was identified only as Shorty, raced to help others. Despite suffering a broken arm, he is credited with carrying 4 people to safety, using his good arm to carry out his heroic efforts. But perhaps the most tragic account is that of Fred and Blanche Kempf. They were proprietors of the Model City, as it was known, and it was described as a wonderful mechanical and electrical marvel. It was a model of what a future city might look like. Fred Kempf had started building this when he was 16 years old, and it took him 5 years to build. It was described as a miniature town with automobiles, streetcars, and buildings that operated automatically. A few weeks before the fatal wreck, a Macon newspaper wrote of Fred Kempf, "He ranks with Edison and other great men of the day, and his Model City will survive him and live as a fitting monument to perpetuate his memory." At the time of the wreck, Fred and Hazel Kempf and their 2-year-old daughter were sleeping in their auto truck that was loaded onto one of the flat cars. It might have been on the first flat car behind the locomotive. Realizing the fate as the fire consumed the train, they threw their daughter Hazel from their automobile window to those trying to save them. They could not escape the fire. As one account noted, it seemed the irony of fate that his life work should be his funeral pyre. While Fred and Blanche Kempf died that day, their daughter Hazel did not. "I don't remember anything about the wreck," she recalled. "All I know about it is what I've heard others tell." Years later, Hazel Kempf married Lester Mack. They were stage actors. Hazel Mack went on to a successful stage acting career. She also worked as the manager of the New York City Convention and Visitors Bureau and was also secretary of the Screen Actors Guild in New York. She died in January 1998 at the age of 84. When we look back at this particular wreck, perhaps the real tragedy is how many people died in the wreck. A front page headline in the Atlanta Constitution proclaimed 24 lives reported lost in fire when Carnival train is wrecked and head-on crash near Columbus. William F. Floto, the circus's press agent, reported that the exact number of people killed in the wreck will never be known, as many of the dead were not working for the show, but for concessions people, and there is no record of their names or whether they were on the train or not. And if you read press accounts from shortly after that, there are many examples of people trying to find their loved ones. There was an Atlanta man named E.T. Cooey who sought to find his brother, J.A. Cooey, who had joined the circus and left town when it was in Atlanta. The next month in Decatur, Georgia, the wife of L.L. Brooks, a Georgia Railway and Power Company motorman, was convinced that her husband's body was one of those recovered from the wreck. And there were other reports of unidentified bodies being pulled from the wreckage who were never identified. Yet, officially, according to the Interstate Commerce Commission, only 7 people on board the circus train died. 27 employees were injured, as were 3 passengers and 4 railroad employees. For what it's worth, the railroad blamed the passenger engineer and the conductor of that train for not following orders and waiting on the circus train to pass. Con T. Kennedy, the proprietor of the circus, eventually purchased a lot in Columbus's Riverside Cemetery, and lore holds it that the charred remains of circus workers and animals were both buried in a mass grave in the cemetery. In January 1916, Kennedy returned to Columbus to make arrangements for a marble memorial to stand over the graves of his fallen comrades. The marker still stands in the cemetery today. When he returned to Columbus, Kennedy told a local newspaper that 6 people were probably buried in the cemetery and that 16 people were unaccounted for. The circus held a small ceremony on March 8th of that year, and more than 1,000 people turned out to pay their respects. For his part, Con T. Kennedy rebuilt the circus. The show did, in fact, go on. The railroad built new equipment made of steel. When Kennedy died suddenly at 53 years old in Greenville, Mississippi, in December 1924, his obituaries didn't mention the 1915 wreck in Columbus. Time had moved on. It was ancient history by then. At the time, though, said Kennedy, rather my whole train had been consumed by the flames than that one of the people who worked for me should have lost his life. As I noted when I was researching and writing my book about the Memphis, Clarksville, and Louisville Railroad, history at times leaves us with an incomplete record from which to work. And almost every project I've compiled about railroads was a work in progress when it went to the printer. You could say the same for a topic such as death on the rails. There are so many directions you could go researching, wrecks large and small that are worth investigating. There are just so many railroad stories to tell. And for as many stories as we, as in the royal we, have told throughout history, we've really only scratched the surface. When we look at railroads and tell their history, we often overlook the human story. I think we tend to focus on the railroads themselves as companies, their rolling stock, their locomotives, the lines that they operated, their earnings. We don't always think about the human factor. But I think when we do talk about the human factor, I think we tend to ponder it in the context of the railroad workers themselves, not necessarily the unwitting participants in history. What about Hazel Kemp, who carried a scar with her for the rest of her life? A literal one on her forehead, and no doubt a figurative one inside. Now, for her part, the railroad paid her $15,200, a small price to pay for the railroad. It was just simply the cost of doing business. But her story isn't unique. Railroads often paid out claims to survivors of horrible tragedies or to the family members affected by those horrible tragedies. The trains kept running, and the tragedies fell from the headlines in just a couple of days. And in doing so, they fell from our collective memories. That's as true today as it was in 1830. And unfortunately, the same will probably be true tomorrow. Not every train wreck is memorialized in song. Not every hero is immortalized as a folk legend. But that doesn't mean their efforts are any less valuable or that their stories are any less worthy of remembering. As railroads approach 200 years of shaping and dramatically transforming the country, we should pause for a moment to remember the cost that led us to where we are today. It's probably human nature to want to block out the tragedies. After all, who wants to go and sit and watch trains or go to a train museum and start pondering their deadly past? It's a great way to demoralize an otherwise fun hobby. But we don't always have the chance to avoid tragedy. We don't always have the choice to avoid tragedy. Sometimes it finds us with little warning. Fate doesn't usually call ahead to confirm a time. But that doesn't mean we can't seize the opportunity to remember. Because what I came to the conclusion of is if there's one lesson that we can take from the many deaths on the rails, it's that it's never too late to remember or to learn from those who preceded us.
I hope you enjoyed this presentation. Please check back for more from my talk on Death on the Rails. For railfanning.org, I'm Todd DeFeo. Be sure to visit railfanning.org for more news, features, and photos from the rails.